I don't know about you guys, but I like it when Roman numerals spell something vaguely naughty.
What do you mean, Sam?
Well, isn't it X-Lix this year?
Oh, yes.
Super Bowl X-Lix.
X-Lix. Yeah.
I think it's the rival to a digestive medication.
Or a very not very tasty type of candy. Welcome to Ask an Atheist with me, Sam Olvey, 844-SKEPTIC. That's 844-753-7842. And joining me today is Dave. How are you?
I want to know. I'm giving up watching the Super Bowl to be here today because the Super Bowl is happening right now.
You are a lying liar who lies. Also joining us is Rebecca. How are you?
I'm here too.
So we're going to open up with an email. This is one we haven't gotten in a while. This is Lauren from the internet who writes, "Hi, I just wondered if you believe that love exists. As soon as you could get back to me on this, the better. Thanks." Well, you didn't leave a phone number, so I guess this will have to do. This is one we get a lot, is, you know, if we don't believe in God or we can't believe in things we can't touch or see or whatever, you know, how do you believe in love? Clearly, you know, you're married, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It gets a little old.
Well, we hate each other and we just do this in order for the tax breaks.
Yeah,
and of course.
No, it's only natural selection pressure that causes us to be together. Yeah, otherwise it's just dislike all the time. I don't know. How about you, Dave?
Well, I have on this one, I remember this coming up with my wife a while ago, back when she was still a believer. And my concept was like, I think she was trying to ask me, without God, without this cosmic significance, how can love actually mean anything? And I think that's a really strange stance. Like, without cosmic significance, there can be no significance.
Right.
Like, I believe that love is a reaction in my brain, a chemical reaction, and that's the extent of it. But that doesn't mean that being in love isn't awesome. Like, it doesn't mean I don't love my wife. It's, you know, just because it has a very simple explanation doesn't mean the experience is any less profound.
Right. I think they're trying to be reductionist, as they're trying to say, well, if love is just a release of chemicals into the brain and the interaction between cells in the brain, why is love important? But if you extend that further, I am a release of chemicals and interactions between cells within the brain. Therefore, if I attach importance to that, which, by the way, I do, then of course I'm going to attach importance to something that affects that, and especially affects that in what I perceive as a positive way.
In conversations with religious individuals or spiritual individuals, they'll say things like, God is love. My conception of God is that God is love.
Right.
And if to someone who holds to that belief, you say, I don't believe in God, then that would eliminate you believing in love. Well, I'm sorry, just because you have a conception of God that God is love doesn't mean that that's everyone's. It doesn't mean that someone who doesn't believe in God doesn't acknowledge love.
There's a nuanced position here, which means it's I should never talk about on the radio because people hate nuance. But what they're saying is because you don't believe in God, therefore you can't believe in love because there are things that you can't touch and there are things that you can't measure. However, I think it's a little bit more subtle. I believe in the belief in God.
You understand and acknowledge.
I understand that there are people in the world who believe in God, and when they believe in God, it does something to their happy bits of their brain, and there's a release of chemicals. What is it? Oxycontin?
Oxycontin is the drug.
Oh.
Serotonin?
Oxytocin love hormone.
I've been on painkillers all week. It's basically the same to me.
Avoid dental procedures, Sam. No, oxytocin is that love hormone. It's the hormone that typically infants get when they breastfeed or when they hear their
right.
parents' voices.
But the thing is, it's something you can measure. Similarly, you can measure when someone is in love. There is a thing that you can check.
You can do what functional MRI scans of the brain. You can measure secretions of different hormones. Stress hormones decrease. Serotonin, oxytocin increases.
If you choose to describe it merely on that functional level, more power to you. But that's not how I choose to describe it. Just because something exists on that level in hardware doesn't mean that the software doesn't have any sort of value. And I hate to resort to computer analogies because the brain is not a computer. It's a gland. I get that. But it works here. And so I'm going to use it.
Well, and I think the important question is the question of regression. Do you believe in love after love?
Do I believe in love after love? Oh. Isn't that a Queen song?
Cher, I believe.
Oh, Cher. Okay.
Life after love?
Yeah. So I hope this works for you, Lauren, because, you didn't leave a phone number, so we can't call you back.
It is one that atheists will often get.
Yeah.
Because it's sometimes very hard if you have attachments to your conception of God and your spirituality as being inextricably linked with love. If you don't have that, well, where do you get your love?
And I think it comes from an inadequate understanding of what exactly it is we think when we speak of being materialists in a philosophical sense, is that we believe that this world that we live in with all of these nouns and verbs is the only world that is. And we are interactions between cells. And so they seem to think that they understand that we think we live in that sort of universe only partially. They still seem to think that we believe we have a soul or something like that. Therefore, what is the importance of love? Love is exactly the same thing that I am. My identity is. They come from the same place, from the same source. Interactions between cells in my head. Or as Ron John told me once, mind is what brain does.
Right. And I will say that there are concepts that come along with the romantic idea of love that I don't buy into. I don't buy into the idea of a soulmate.
Like, right.
I think that's absurd. being destined to be with somebody. I don't buy any of that.
Yeah, there's a pile of dependencies there that don't necessarily follow, I guess I would say.
There's that brilliant Tim Minchin song where, you know, if I weren't with you, I'd be with somebody else.
But the bottom line is that atheists do form attachments. We form relationships. They're integral to our being, to our happiness. And just because you don't believe in some predestined, you know, lover or soulmate or God determining your love or
and
your...
to take all the fun of it out of it, there are evolutionary reasons to do all of these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is extremely beneficial for your survival to form attachments, to form communities that, you know, of people that care for one another.
So, there you go.
Love
is boring, apparently. A statue of a sea god in Northern Ireland was stolen last week and replaced with a wooden cross. The statue, which was installed a year ago as part of a Limavady sculpture trail, was designed to commemorate local myths and legends. The sculpture, which was made of fiberglass and steel, would have taken a number of men and a few hours with tools to remove, according to the sculptor. The cross that was left behind said, "You shall have no other gods before me." So, any leads as to who might be involved?
Yeah, there is no actual statement that this was done by some evangelist Christians. I think there's some hints. There's a clue or two that might lead the authorities in that direction,
yeah, and
perhaps.
Well, there's been a very limited history of religiously motivated violence in Ireland.
Oh,
so,
of course.
Yeah, isn't that, so, yeah. this is completely out of hand. I don't know. Where are you on this one, Becky?
I still like the idea of a sculpture garden with different mythical features and legends and things like that. It reminds me of the solution to the Ten Commandments in public areas in the United States. It's like the really, really pretty, high-cultured version of the putt-putt field.
Fair enough.
I'm actually really intrigued by this. I think it's a beautiful idea to have sort of an artistic expression and acknowledging of different folktales, myths, legends, things like that. It's a great use of art in public space.
It's a weird one that you hear in fundamentalism a lot, is just because we acknowledge that people have believed in weird mythological gods in history, that means that we believe in them now because we think pictures of them or sculptures of them are cool.
Yeah. It's let's just ignore our own history here.
Yeah.
This actually reminds me of, I'm gonna digress on something which might sound a little funny to you guys, but at my college had an art museum, and in the art museum, the restrooms were actually part of the exhibits. So for about 15 minutes every hour, the restrooms would be open to anyone for viewing. And in one of the restrooms, it was artistic tile work, and it actually depicted different creation myths and creation legends. So what I'm thinking here is, I'm sort of mapping this same person, whoever decided to pluck up the sea god and replace it with a cross, going into the college art museum and smashing all the porcelain toilets and
so
and
was
the
singularity
tiles.
That created the Big Bang, was it actually in like a urinal or a toilet, and then you flushed it, and then it created like everything else?
That was one of the jokes of what should have been exhibited.
It wasn't. What a lost opportunity.
Creation myths, Sam. Creation myths. Creation stories. Creation
Fair
myths.
Fair enough.
Not actual cosmology of how things came to be.
Well, then.
Not formation
then
stories.
You just fake it. You put somebody with a button next to it. Because that's a lot, frankly, that's what a lot of Christians believe if they stick with the Big Bang these days, is that, oh yeah, the Big Bang happened, just God pressed a button.
And
things Kaboom. Happened. Yeah.
You're going to get in the neck for that one. We're going to have some emails. You can email in saying, yeah, I don't think it was God pressing a button.
This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about blasphemy a lot.
Billy, I am a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide $1 billion in your locker.
Wow, $1 billion?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
Imagine tropical waters, warm sandy beaches, friendly people, incredible weather. The English-speaking Caribbean island of St. Lucia awaits. Don Summers and his team at Professional Realty Group are ready to assist you. Whether you're looking for an investment, a place to retire, or a killer vacation property, St. Lucia has homes in all price ranges starting at $110,000. Call Don at 780-237-4718 and check out dndrealty.ca.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842, toll-free nationwide. The town of Greece, New York, has included two atheist groups on its list of groups invited to deliver invocations at council meetings.
Yay!
The atheist community of Rochester and the Sunday Assembly Rochester will both be given the chance to open meetings with secular invocations. Greece was the defendant in the Greece versus Galloway Supreme Court case. So this is basically the final finish him of this particular one.
Yeah, and it's a really great story because they allowed one secular person, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but last year to give an invocation. But then they said that they were changing their policy for who can give invocations. They were reaching out to community religious groups. And we thought that this was their way to sort of end around to avoid giving seculars a chance again.
Right.
But they on their own included these two groups. They actually reached out to Secular Assembly of, or Sunday Assembly Rochester and the Atheist Community of Rochester. Those groups had asked in the previous years, but when they put together their list, they made sure to include two secular groups. So I think it's like, wow, they've finally come around. Well
done. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Town of Greece, New York, for following the Supreme Court ruling.
It's a good one. It's a nice resolution.
This is a nice resolution. This is exactly what we should see in a situation where we believe that legislation is going to open up with these invocations. It should be inclusive. It should be pluralistic. Mm-hmm. And this is a step in that direction. I guess it goes back to what I was saying before. I'd almost prefer that we just not do this. If they go one particular group every time they do a legislative session, I guess that's okay. It doesn't take up too much time. I suppose that works. But mm-hmm. I just see a lot of, much like the nativity scenes, I see this eventually ending up somewhere really weird.
I think you're exactly right. I think that it's a really nice nod to the pluralistic nature of people's, the diversity of belief and non-belief that there is in New York State and in the country. But at some point, you're never going to be able to be inclusive of every single person's religious belief or religious background.
But still, congratulations to all those groups in New York, to Atheist Community of Rochester and Sunday Assembly Rochester. Really good job, guys. This is an important one, not just for you, but for everybody. So yeah. Thank you very much. I wish I could keep the good news coming. Unfortunately, a second county in Washington is proposing to display In God We Trust in its council chambers. Clark County Councilor Tom Milkey is proposing to install the display next to the county motto, Proud Past, Promising Future. Milkey has been in contact with In God We Trust America, a group advocating for the public display of the national motto. The only other Washington county that has approved the display is Pierce County, home of Ask an Atheist. Hi. Milkey says that he doesn't expect much backlash over the proposal.
Take it away, Sam.
Oh, boy. Doesn't expect much back, muck, much backlash. Muck batchlash? I know, whatever. I
believe Rick McCune didn't expect much backlash.
Jim McCune, yeah. Didn't expect much backlash. He's like, I don't know what's going on here. I don't see why anybody would complain about this.
I'm so surprised that anyone would have a problem with this.
So I
get ready to be surprised, Milkey.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, you know, I have said before that not only do I do this show, but I'm also president of Humanists of Washington, which is a statewide organization, which means we got a, you know, we got a stake in this one.
Mm-hmm.
But we also know that there are groups down in Clark County who might want to say something about this.
And it's funny with the how Clark County is. It's home of Vancouver, which is a city in Washington, but it's right across the bridge in the water from Portland, Oregon. And so you have sort of a greater Portland area of the secular community, a lot of whom, you know, live in Vancouver and in Clark County. And to say that this is not divide, I mean, I can even envision sort of the arguments right now. This is something that's our national motto, and I have no idea why anyone would be surprised by this or would be offended by this.
Well, part of the reason that you're able to foresee a lot of this is that you actually spoke with In God We Trust America, which is one person, I believe.
Yes, In God We Trust America, Inc., is the brainchild of one woman who served as a municipal leader in somewhere in California. And I did. I spoke with her on the phone. I asked her further questions about this. I asked her questions about whether this was meant to be, In God We Trust was meant to glorify or acknowledge all people's understandings of God, even those who are non-believers. And she said, well, that's what all of the people will say, but we all know that it's our Heavenly Father, right? And to me, that's just the hallmark. That's just the tip of the iceberg about where this movement comes from,
right,
about the origin or the motivation behind proudly and prominently displaying our national motto. Yes, we get it. It's our national motto. That's a fight that's been fought and we lost. We're not going to change that at the moment.
Not immediately.
But the fact is that we don't have to say we're going to plaster this all over our municipal, you know, buildings, our schools, our chambers, our, you know, city halls, our courthouses. You don't have to. There's no law that says you have to put the national motto in everything. There's certainly no law that says you have to put God on everything. And in my opinion, we shouldn't. We shouldn't be scrambling to paste God on the walls of our government buildings.
Absolutely. And speaking of Pierce County, I know the law passed, but last time I was in there, and nobody's told me otherwise, In God We Trust is not yet posted there.
Really? I hadn't been in there since the last time we went in there, so I hadn't heard anything.
It was a resolution to plan to put it on the wall.
Right.
Well, and one of the things that a smidgen of credit I will give to Councillor Tom Mielke here is that he is admitting that he's working with this incorporation woman.
Yeah, and which is something that McCune didn't do.
Yeah, McCune pretended like it was his own idea, even though we have pictures of him with the paperwork from the organization in front of him as he was suggesting this.
Yeah.
And he's straight out lying to us. And I think that one bothers me more, the fact that he was lying to us.
Mm.
So, you know, I will give Mielke a smidgen of credit for at least being honest about, you know, hey, there's this lady pushing this thing. I like it. Let's do it.
Well, chances are he's probably learned from what happened here, but apparently not enough to not make it a thing.
Yeah.
Because is this absolutely necessary? Will this help the...
It's a waste of time and
money. It's a waste of time. It's for voters.
Mm-hmm.
Like McCune, I'm assuming that there's a lot of evangelists in his district.
Yeah.
And this is just the way to play to his base.
Now he can put this on a mailer and send it out for the next election. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
And that works sometimes, doesn't work all the times. The International Humanist and Ethical Union has begun a worldwide campaign to end blasphemy laws. The campaign, which was launched in response to the Charlie Hebdo attacks, is intended to support smaller local groups who are already trying to put a stop to the laws. According to Pew Research, there are currently 47 nations with some form of blasphemy laws on the books. Does that include us?
I'm not sure whether we are included on that. Now, blasphemy laws,
no, we're not.
As we've discussed in the past, it's not just saying blasphemy is illegal, but also things like criticizing religion, things that are called things like religious libel or defamation of religious beliefs. Those are in an even greater number of countries, and countries that you wouldn't necessarily think of, like the UK, like Austria, in the United States, we have a law that says you can't incorporate your business with a blasphemous business name.
Right. That's in Philadelphia, yes?
That was the case, I think, that brought that to be. But yeah, some states still have some form of anti-religious defamation or anti-religious libel or, you know, anti-blasphemy laws. It's kind of funny to some degree. But the problem there is that it restricts people's abilities to criticize ideas and to critically examine ideas.
And interestingly enough, in, you know, the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, people are beginning to see exactly what people on the other side of the debate have been saying for so long. If you limit speech, people believe they have the right to run ramshot all over you, to basically trammel your rights because their God tells them to. And that, if that's not what Charlie Hebdo was, what is?
Yeah, and it's an unfortunate state of the world that you're not going to be able to stop attacks like the Charlie Hebdo attacks with changing laws, unless you change the foundational understanding of how to do religion and how to accept people being able to accept offense. People understanding is like, look, you don't actually have to believe what I believe, and what you say may bother me, but my response to that is not going to be violent towards you. This is not going to really change that, but it's a step in the right direction.
You may not be able to change whether someone is going to violently attack someone for doing something that's critical of religion. But what you will do if you take away the blasphemy laws is take away a government sanctioning of this offense. When you say that religious defamation should be illegal and is punishable by fines or by prison time, you are saying that people do have a right to be offended, and then the person who is the actor in this offensive act has the right to be punished. And when you take away the blasphemy laws, you take away a government's legitimizing of that offense and of that reaction.
That's exactly what's going on here. I mean, for example, we have another news story. Two humanist groups in New Zealand are making a push to repeal the country's blasphemy law. The Humanist Society of New Zealand and the New Zealand Association of Rationalists and Humanists argue that the law could be abused in the future and that repealing it would allow the nation to criticize similar laws in other countries without looking hypocritical. Defenders of the law say that there is symbolic reasons recognizing the importance of belief. Blasphemy libel was made a part of the Crimes Act in 1961 and has never been enforced. So what we have here is we're starting this sort of international dialogue on the nature of blasphemy and the freedom to speak one's mind and the freedom to say things that might be considered, you know, blasphemous or whatever in somebody else's culture. Because, frankly, there's very little you can say that isn't considered blasphemous to someone.
Right.
In just about any situation you can name. And it's very difficult for a lot of these forward-thinking nations, or nations that believe themselves to be thinking forward-thinking, if we're being honest, to have this dialogue and say, yeah, people should be allowed to speak, when they almost uniformly have these blasphemy laws on the books. They're just not they're just not using them.
This is really coming to a head as nations, or as ministers in particular nations, are zoning in on places like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, who are persecuting atheists, who are persecuting people of minority religions, to some really gruesome ends in some cases. Pakistan, right. You have people that get the death penalty for the supposed crime of insulting the Prophet or insulting Islam, where even repeating in court what the alleged offense was itself is considered blasphemy.
Right.
You have in Saudi Arabia, people risk death for apostasy, for leaving their religion, or public flogging for insulting religion. And it's very hard for, say, New Zealand to be speaking out against that when you yourself have a similar law. It may not, the punishment may be fines and 2 years jail time. It may not be public flogging.
But then it just becomes a discussion of degree and not of the fact that you should be allowed to speak.
And the fact of the matter is that Pakistan, when it goes before the UN to defend itself and defend its own law, uses Ireland's constitutional blasphemy law as backup and saying, look, Ireland does it. We should be able to have one as well.
Funny you should mention that. A junior minister in Ireland says that there will be a vote to take the anti-blasphemy law out of the Irish constitution by the end of the year. Aidan O'Riordan said that a referendum on same-sex marriage was the focus of the first half of the year, but there would be a number of referendums in the second half, including one to repeal the blasphemy law. The Department of Justice wouldn't comment on the timing for such a referendum, but only that it would happen when the necessary legislation was drafted.
Let's get drafting, boys.
Yeah.
The timing is now. Like,
right.
And that's one of the things about all of these stories is that there is a serious push for zero tolerance on this issue anymore. We aren't going to accept even the calmest, most toothless blasphemy law anymore. Having them on the law books is unacceptable.
Absolutely. It feels a little Cassandra-y, I suppose, because people in the free thought movement and people who have been talking about freedom of religion and freedom to not be constrained by religion have been talking for years about the problem with blasphemy laws. We've done talks on it, but the American Humanist Association has been talking about this a lot. American Atheists have been talking about this a lot. The international organizations have been talking about this a lot. It comes up in the UN every now and again, but nobody really listens to it. Nobody really believes it because nobody saw a crisis. Well, it took 14 people being shot, and now it's a crisis. Now it's a conversation that we're having. This isn't so much I told you so as it just sometimes is the occasional disgust I feel as a humanist towards humans.
Why weren't you listening?
The alternate side to that is now we can say we've been advocating for this for a long time and we are buoyed by others also coming to fight the good fight.
And well, when you fight the good fight, there's a group on the other side as well. An organization of Muslim scholars has released a statement calling for the drafting of a blasphemy law to be submitted to the UN. The International Union of Muslim Scholars wants defamation of religion to be prohibited to protect Muslim communities. The group celebrated peaceful protests against drawings of Muhammad in primary Muslim countries, but urged people not to resort to violence. The group also claimed that allowing publications like Charlie Hebdo to publish pictures of Muhammad gives credibility to the idea that the West is against Islam. Well, first and foremost, thank you for keeping your protests nonviolent. Thank you for playing the game as it's supposed to be, as it's supposed to be played.
And here's the thing. We are advocating for your right to protest in that form, to speak out. We will fight to death for your right to speak out against blasphemy, so long as you allow other people to speak as well.
Death is pretty strong. Can we say pretty nasty paper cut or something
pretty
like that?
Pretty nasty paper cut?
Yeah. But that is the thing, is if Charlie Hebdo has the right to make really horrible looking cartoons, which I can say that they have a right to do that, then you have a right to say, hey, that's bad, and to have that conversation in the public square.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't have to back it up with the force of law.
The thing that is a little bit baffling to me is that Muslim communities need to be protected through a law prohibiting defamation of religion. It is freedom of speech and freedom of religion that precisely protects religious minorities.
Yeah.
If you didn't have that freedom to express yourselves as you would, or your freedom to worship or not worship as you see fit, then what is to say that your government can't come and prohibit any of those particular actions? We see that in the United States, that freedom of religion and the clause of the Constitution that allows that is the one that protects the Amish from saying, I don't want to, have a driver's license. I want to drive my buggy down the street.
Right.
It protects, Jehovah's Witness from having to pledge allegiance. It protects any number of people from saying oaths when they take public office. It protects atheists for certain. But that kind of law that protects and enshrines freedom of expression actually protects the Muslim communities, actually protects those minority religious groups.
And tactically, I really feel like tying blasphemy to the protection of Muslim minority communities. They don't say minority communities, but clearly that's what they're trying to refer to here.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty low.
Yeah.
Tell you what, if you think Muslim minority communities need protection under law, why don't you write laws to protect those communities and to protect those people, not ideas?
Yeah.
I'd back you on that one. Sometimes people need extra protection under the law. Look at our history. Just take a little peek at U.S. history.
Yeah.
And I think you might see some examples of that. And I'm not necessarily against it. But once you start saying that because these people are under threat, you can't have these ideas in the public square.
Well, and laws like this are self-defeating in the first place because, what Muslims say is blasphemous to Christians, to Jews,
but even
to
further,
Buddhists.
Even further beyond that, let's say that there's people out there who are a threat to these minority communities,
mm-hmm.
and they say blasphemous stuff just as we do in the public square. Do you think banning blasphemy in the public square is going to make those frightening people go away? Do you think this actually provides us with protection?
Absolutely not.
It doesn't. It just makes them quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you want the jerks to be jerky in public so that you know that they're jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what discussion in the public square is about.
I think in terms of looking at in predominantly Muslim communities, and let's say Pakistan, for instance, we see that blasphemy is used as a way not to protect Muslims, but as a way to persecute people of minority religious groups in that place, and not even of minority religions. It's being used in personal disputes. All you have to do is have one blasphemy accusation, and then suddenly this person is at risk of a death sentence. And you can see that over financial disputes, and this is, you know, past episodes that we've had have discussed this. We've looked at specific cases on this.
Yeah.
You have financial disputes, you have custody disputes, you have land disputes, and all you have to do is say you insulted the prophet, and now you have very little recourse.
It's worth pointing out that Raif Badawi has avoided the lash, literally, for the third straight week, and indications are that the Saudi government might be caving to international pressure. Now, that's something we heard on Twitter from a BBC correspondent,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, a BBC reporter put that tweet out, and it's kind of an important little touchstone. It's to remind people that what we do works.
Right.
Even against the Saudi government, if they are caving to international pressure, well, who's bringing that pressure? It's people like us and other people who speak out against the mistreatment of people for blasphemy.
Is it just pressure, or is it pressure combined with the fact that there's a change in government going on in Saudi Arabia right now? Like, you know, oh, got to look good for the international scene. So I guess lashing this guy for saying things might not be a good thing.
Well, his case was sent back to the courts by the office of the king before Abdulaziz died. So
okay,
the gears were in motion before that happened. So I think, no, there is actually real evidence that it is just international pressure that's making them change their stance on this. But I think it's key to note that what they're probably are going to do is like, all right, we're going to show mercy for Raif and then keep the laws in the books, and we're just going to have the same conversation 6 months down the road.
Well, yeah, it's a theocracy. I don't think we should be expecting anything else. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go into a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Dr. Steve Anonymous. We talked about him last week. He's the guy who's being forced by the courts to attend Catholic Mass, and the story is even weirder than I thought.
Seattle Atheists and Camp Quest Northwest are teaming up to celebrate with a day of games and interactive science crafts. See fossils older than the dinosaurs. Teens and adults, test your knowledge by competing in Evolution Jeopardy. Kids get their very own science activity room. Go to meetup.com/Seattle Atheists for more information and to register your kids.
Darwin Day 2015 at the 2100 building in Seattle on Saturday, February 14th at 1 p.m. Go to seattleatheists.org for details.
Dr. Steve Anonymous is a psychologist living in the UK. An atheist, Steve was ordered to take his child to Mass as part of his divorce and custody arrangement by a Roman Catholic magistrate. He joins us from England and is no relation to Rodney. How are you doing today, Steve?
Yeah, hi. Good to be here.
Fantastic. So, first and foremost, why are we calling you Steve Anonymous?
Oh, you have to call me Anonymous for legal reasons. There are a lot of technicalities in British law, some of them good, some of them bad, but I have to be careful what I say, and I certainly can't draw attention to my identity. There's a possible prison sentence, so best to keep it straight.
That's a big one. So we talked about this last week, and then you contacted us about this. What are you allowed to share with us about your divorce and custody proceedings at this point?
We should talk about the aspect of being sent to church. That's the aspect we can talk about, and the aspect we should talk about.
Okay, so give us a sense of the narrative there, where you're sitting in the courtroom, or the, you know, the local variant thereof, and the magistrate just says, you're going to Mass?
Well, it was quite a senior court. It was a senior judge. Pretty much. You had most of the facts right last week. A couple of things are out. We can sort them out today.
Okay.
Yes, I was in court, and the judge regaled us with a couple of anecdotes of his experience in Catholic Church. My former wife, to her credit, never asked for any kind of ruling in relation to attendance.
Right.
You did say she wasn't a practicing Catholic. That's not quite right. She is now,
okay,
but she wasn't prior to the separation. The children never went to Christmas Mass before separation. But she didn't ask for this. And the judge, after sharing with us his Catholic experience. Firstly, stop me having the boys at weekends when, of course, there's Mass. And then, because he couldn't control Christmas like that, he said, if I had them at Christmas, I had to take them to Mass. So obviously, from my point of view, I see that all my childcare arrangements are really organized around his religious belief.
Wow. You tried appealing under Article 9 of the European Council on Human Rights. How did that work out for you?
Yes, the European Convention on Human Rights, that's right. Well, not that well, because the courts just ignored that aspect of my complaint. They kept ignoring it until just the end of last year, when finally, in an appeal to a judicial review, I insisted that the judge, I told that I was entitled to a ruling under ECHR Article 9, and he ruled it was too minor an infringement. Would you like to hear what ECHR Article 9 says?
Yes, please.
Absolutely.
It could be quite helpful, because obviously in America you have your own rules about this.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Well, this is quite simple and straightforward, and one would think it's clear. Okay, there's only two points. Point one, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in worship, teaching, practice, and observance. Point two, freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs shall be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law and are necessary in a democratic society in the interests of public safety, for the protection of public order, health or morals, or for the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. Which I think is fairly clear.
I would agree.
Do you think that the issue here is that you have your own freedom to conscience or religious observance, but your children have to, you know, have some kind that is independent of yours?
My youngest son really isn't old enough to have a say, I don't think. My eldest son is old enough to say, and it's quite clear that he does not believe. I obviously don't believe.
Right.
So it's my freedom of thought and conscience and belief, and it's my eldest son's freedom of thought, conscience and belief. And of course, the words are clear, to manifest his religion or belief in worship, teaching, practice and observance. There's nothing more clear than being told where to go for a religious ceremony. That is clearly contrary to what that says. So effectively, I'm sure in America, the same as here, is that precedent defines law.
Right.
So effectively, ECHR Article 9 has just changed for everyone in Europe because of this case, in that, if you like, there's a bracket at the end, except, you know, I will now phrase it off the top of my head in brackets, sure. There's a kind of brackets at the end, which is, except a judge may send someone to church or synagogue or mosque, you know, you could say, there is, unless you're going to tell me a qualitative difference between me and a Muslim, for example, you cannot tell me that there's a difference between attending me to Catholic Mass or my oldest son or a Muslim to a synagogue. It's not a slippery slope. It's the same thing.
Well, there's a phrase here that really caught me off guard when you're talking about it. Not big enough an infraction? They actually said that?
Yeah. Yeah. Those were the very words. I think that's the exact quote, but it's certainly the meaning.
Yeah. So there's some sort of threshold. They're not going to tell you what the threshold is,
no.
But there is a threshold.
Oh, no.
Right.
There's a threshold, but I don't meet it. What would meet the threshold? Well, I'll go the other way. I think I know what should be caught up in this. I think if someone was to deny someone blood transfusions because of their religion, I would see how that could be contradicted by the limitations in the Act.
Right.
So I could see that would be a sensible limitation. I quote, the interests of public safety. I think you could identify a child who has been denied blood transfusion to be that sort of area. But obviously, I'm not in that area. My son isn't in that area. Catholic Church doesn't have any such limitations. So, it is rather strange.
So, out of curiosity, and forgive my ignorance as an American who doesn't pay attention to the rest of the world, but in the U.S., all our law...
Dave, I used to say that, but I can't say that anymore, can I? Because, well, you're talking to me, so we'll...
this is true. But my question, because in the U.S., the law, kind of the Constitution is the supreme law. Everything ends at the Constitution. How does what's the jurisdiction of this European Convention of Human Rights? Like, how... Is there laws that supersede it in England, or does it supersede all English law, or how does that work?
Previously, it was where we could go if British law let us down. Now what's happened, I think about 15 years ago, is we incorporated the convention into our law. So in effect, it is our supreme act, our supreme law. Very, really comparable to your constitution. It's pretty much the bottom line.
Okay.
So you mentioned some hypothetical cases of if you had a Jewish judge, for instance, that ordered a Muslim individual to bring their children to synagogue. Those are hypothetical cases, but are you familiar with any other similar past cases in the UK of, you know, parents being forced to bring their children to church?
We think this is the first case, certainly the first we know of anywhere in Europe. There may be another, we haven't heard of it. So this is precedent, this has changed things. So it's really after this where everything can be different. And to be clear, I don't think anyone wants this. I think this was, I think the British legal system is a drunk lurching from lamppost to lamppost. there's no higher mind planning this out or wanting. In America, I could see there'd be a lobby arguing for this sort of thing, who would like this sort of thing. But yeah, over here, we don't have your kind of religious lobbies. This is just problems, errors, mistakes, stupidities, and rather like Hobby Lobby. No one thought it through.
Wow. And I really would say, like, this is a real case of activist judges. I know here they always bring up that term whenever there's a judgment they don't like, but in this case, it's a judgment taking his personal beliefs and applying them to you, whether you like it or not.
That's how it appears to me, certainly. Again, I it's hard for me to look at a fault in one place, because I think this judge made a really bad mistake at the end of business on a Friday, when, frankly, if he was that tired, he shouldn't have been dealing with my case. It was too important. But putting that aside, you know, the system should have kicked in and corrected this. That's what appeals are for.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, the appeals didn't correct this. They didn't put things right. And that's where our problem lies.
So, Steve, you've talked about some of the wider implications, but specifically for your family, one of the things that the Telegraph stated in an article about you was that you face contempt of court charges if you fail to attend mass or if you fail to abide by this order.
Yes.
What does that entail?
Just as if I were to give my identity to you, up to 2 years in prison.
Oh, wow.
That would certainly interfere with the custody of your children, I would imagine.
It might cause one or two difficulties, yeah.
Yes. What have you done? I mean, have you brought your boys to church? If you're allowed to disclose.
Church and us are strangers. I put it like, if the courts aren't going to give my eldest son, particularly because he's old enough to decide, if the courts aren't going to give my son's freedom of thought, I will. Ultimately, some people have suggested that the true test of this would be if I was taken to court for a contempt of court, risking up to 2 years in prison, in order to fight it. The system is struggling to find a way out of this now. Maybe they'll try and find some kind of fudge for me, but a fudge isn't really acceptable because it leaves the precedent on the books. So even if they solve it for me, it's really not the issue. The issue is that everybody in Europe... an incredible number of people have their rights have now changed by precedent. So yes, I don't think they'll put me in prison. I think they'll draw attention to the mistakes they've made. It's possible that could be a case where we could break the decision, break the precedent, and put us back where we should have been in the first place. Like I say, it's more the reason why we're talking is it's not just about me, not about my boys, but it's about the society we should be living in, and certainly the one I want to be living in.
Right. Now, I can sense usually the kind of questions I get from people who like to disagree with everything I say. You mentioned...
No, you can't.
You mentioned that we got something in the article wrong last week where we said your ex-wife was a non-practicing Catholic but is now a practicing Catholic. And your older son doesn't believe. What was their exposure to religion up to this point?
Very limited. Possibly once or twice they went to church, maybe a bit more. But certainly not more than once or twice a year, and never at Christmas.
Right.
My children have got better things to do at midnight, on Christmas Eve than that be asleep while I skulk around putting things in stockings. Yeah, this is a change to the state of affairs that existed before. So they're not, it's not supporting what pre-existed. It's their change. But like I say, my ex-wife has, whether it's real or not, she has chosen to go to church more regularly and show signs of belief since the separation. Like I say, I can't see inside her head, so I don't know if that represents a belief change or not.
Right.
So one report actually claimed that the judge suggested only granting you access to your children during pagan festivals as opposed to Christmas. Do you think that was a not so subtle dig at someone who is not Catholic or doesn't believe?
Again, it's hard to put myself inside his mind. It's slightly wrong. Well, the suggestion was that at one point he suggested maybe the children could be with their mother at Christmas and with me at the pagan festival, as in New Year. I think the pagan festival is Christmas myself, but yeah. I wasn't going to jump up in church and say that.
So
some truth to that report. To be clear, what you said last week was as accurate as was necessary. You got the principle right, and that's what we're talking about here, principle.
So, out of curiosity, the original custody orders were done in 2009. How come this has kind of become a story and blown up recently?
That's another slight error. Separation started in 2009.
Okay.
The judge made this ruling in 2011, and it's taken from 2011 up to the end of last year for me to run out of fight, to run out of places in which to fight this.
Gotcha.
So, this is why we're out of the courts of courts, and now we're in the court of public opinion.
Gotcha. Okay.
Which is why we're here. The Skeptical, as you know, is a podcast where I contribute. And on their 50th episode, well over a year ago, they invited me to, they invited anybody who was a listener to send a piece in. And I sent in a piece about this. And of course, this was during the process. And so they played that. And then they asked me to contribute every episode, which I now do. And I've been on for some episodes as well, for the whole episode. So they've been there through the final stage of this process. So we knew at the end of last year, this was, coming, if you like, and we prepared for it and blogs were written and everything was prepared so that we could this year, if you like, initiate this process where we're talking to anyone we can, to try and draw attention to this so that we can make a difference.
So in reading a little bit more about your story and about the history of religion in the UK, I came across the recusancy laws that were really eliminated in England, you know, in the 1600s. Those are the laws that, you know, were trying to force Catholics to then go to, you know, Anglican observances. Do you think that this is sort of like some backdoor way to reinstate some of those sort of backwards new recusancy laws?
I think, again, you've got to compare an American religious lobby with British drunken judges. No, not drunken judges. I mean, a legal system that's clinging to lampposts. Now, this is not, in my personal opinion, this is not a strategy. It's not a program. It's worse than that. You could almost understand it if it was deliberate. I don't believe anybody wants this. And I think if the courts could now turn around and change it, they would. They've cornered themselves, and I think the problem has been the legal system has knee-jerk defended itself, and that's probably been a mistake. They should have corrected this.
So, just so that I have the context right here, because something a bit weird about this, as you might imagine, so it was the trial was on Friday, and it sounds like it was towards the end of the day, and the judge just comes up with this crazy idea, thinking that he's being clever. Now your rights are being trampled on, and everybody's backing it up because it's the law, and because they want to back the judge.
Yeah, exactly. The system wants to back the judge, naturally. Once you go into the appeals process, you're really walking uphill against treacle the whole time.
Right.
I will say this, though, that while I was still giving evidence towards the end of Friday in a case which obviously is important to me, I used to be a university lecturer. And when I was a lecturer, you didn't need a clock to tell you when the lecture was about to end, because the students in front of you told you by packing their stuff up.
Yeah.
And that was certainly the impression I got with the judge before he gave this ruling. And of course, he never gave a reason for this ruling. And that's another weird aspect of this case. Like I say, it starts crazy and just gets worse. So obviously you get a court order, and that's where the direction is for me to take the children to mass.
Right.
But you need a judgment, which is like the reasoning, because you can't argue a vacuum, can you? You've got to argue against some substance. And the judge wouldn't actually give any reasons. And in the end, I prosecuted the judge in the High Court to actually get any reasons at all in order to fight appeals. So it was all kind of crazy.
So to this day, you still have no rationale. You have no reason for why he said you got to bring the kids on Christmas. And that would be the thing that you would use in order to argue against the ruling?
That's what I understand. Yes, I haven't seen any reason for that.
It's incredible.
Oh, man.
So in the U.S., we've got a lot of advocacy organizations, from the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Do.
You've got American Humanist Association Legal Division. Are there any support or advocacy organizations in the U.K.?
There are a few, but they're nothing like yours. We don't have a Freedom From Religion Foundation as such. We've got a humanist group, and we've got a secularist group, and Liberty, which is a rights group. None of them are as powerful as yours. I think because the incorporation of the European Convention of Human Rights is relatively new here compared with the date of your constitution, I actually think they're still not finding their feet, really. You know, we haven't had long enough to, and maybe it's things like this that this is maybe what makes organizations. It certainly crossed my mind that maybe we didn't need one before. Only when your rights are threatened do you actually need to start putting a group together, because we don't have your, you don't anymore either, but we don't have your Brian Fishers. We don't hear this sort of thing. I mean, there are people like that, but you don't hear of them. They're very quiet, and no one pays them any attention at all. Whereas I can go onto Right Wing Watch or something and watch a whole host of videos by, frankly, religious nuts.
One of our chief exports is craziness.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah. It's quite interesting that my opinion of America, I suppose, is framed by what I see, and my opinion of America was framed by, before I became involved in atheist podcasting, was framed by what I saw of America, such as the Brian Fishers of the world.
Right.
And so my last year or two, since I've got more and more involved in podcasting, the American voice I hear in my head as I'm working around the farm is a atheist or skeptical voice. So it's quite interesting how that's reversed kind of the aspect of America that I hear.
Well, we're not the ones who own 6 or 7 communication satellites, so it's kind of hard to get our voice out there now and again.
The difference is I don't listen to those.
Yeah, exactly. So this is an incredible story. It makes almost for a comedy if your children and your access to your children weren't at stake. If people want to continue to follow this story, where would I send them?
Oh, well, okay. Well, I shall still be around. If anyone wants to interview me at any point, I shall carry on pushing this campaign.
Absolutely.
Even if it's fudged for me, I'm not going to go away, because it's not about me. Like I say, if it's sold for me, we need it sold for everybody. We need the precedent reversed. You can always find me via the Skepticule Facebook page, which is where I kind of live. There's a petition out there, a change.org petition.
Can you spell, real quick, can you spell out Skepticule for us? Because I know it's a little...
Yes, of course. Skeptic, ULE. Skepticule.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
And the first item always on the Facebook page is the link to the petition. So the best way to get to the petition, where you can make a difference, your listeners can make a difference and help us change this, is to go to the Skepticule Facebook page. You see the link, which is the first item on the page. Go there and express your opinion. If you think it should be changed, you can change it. You can help change it. And frankly, if atheists and skeptics don't do this, if we don't go there and make a difference, it won't change. And it doesn't matter, maybe it doesn't matter now so much. It could matter to me and to my children, of course. But, you know, like I say, let's take some hypothetical situation. It's not going to all this story about Birmingham, by the way, is rubbish. I've regularly been to Birmingham. No, it's not a no-go zone. It's ridiculous. Absolutely crazy. Nothing like that at all. But let's just say something crazy did happen. Let's just say there was enough Muslims even to say there was a Muslim takeover in this country, you know, a democratic takeover. This is a crazy idea, but let's just put it forward that happened. And then they started saying, well, you must go to the mosque. And then we said, yes, but we've got the ECHR, the European Convention of Human Rights. You can't do that. Well, they can point to my case and say, no. It's fairly clear judges can direct people to what places they can go to. Now, this is an outlandish idea, but it shows the importance of the principle. We have to stop it at the very first line it's crossed. Either they can tell us where we can go to pray or not pray or whatever, or they can't. And I say they can't.
People.
They can't make us do that. And we have to tell them. We have to make them know that.
people at the top assume they're going to be at the top forever. I just like did the stuff here in Pierce County with the simple "In God We Trust" sign and said, well, what happens if this, you know, if somebody else wants to put other some other sort of religious icon up on the wall? Say, well, that won't happen because this is a Christian nation. It'll never change. And
glory to the Satanists.
Yeah.
With their books and their statues. You know, absolutely. We don't have them over here either because we don't need them really. You know, but yes, absolutely. I mean, I certainly feel for what they've done. They've done a fantastic job.
So we've mentioned the petition, but I don't think we've described it directly. Can you tell us about the thing on change.org right now?
It's simply to call upon the Minister for Justice, Simon Hughes, to review the case and to examine it and to, presumably to see what went wrong. And like I say, they can fudge it, but I don't think that's not acceptable. They've got to fix it, not fudge it.
Absolutely. Dr. Steve Anonymous is a psychologist living in the UK who is being forced by the courts to take his children to church. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your time.
And that's all the time we've got this week for Ask an Atheist. I'd like to thank Rick from Elma, Washington for meeting Peggy's challenge. I'd like to thank Rebecca Friedman and Dave Brulette. My name is Sam Mulvey. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Steve Anonymous. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Leave us an email at questions@askanatheist.tv. Give us a voicemail at 844-753-7842. Enjoy the Super Bowl. See you guys next week. Blah, 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 blah.